Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, Britain has issued a landmark apology to the Mau Mau freedom fighters of Kenya for its systematic oppression of the Kikuyu people under British colonialization. What does the apology and the reparations fund mean for Kenyans and for the international community? We'll discuss the politics of reparation. Then, as the international community marks World Refugee Day, the global refugee crisis has become worse than in any time since 1994. What's driving the crisis and what should be done to resolve the problem? In 2009, the Mau Mau people of Kenya filed a reparations case in the High Court against Great Britain for human rights abuses, including torture and detention camps during British colonialization of Kenya. Great Britain has now formally acknowledged and apologized to the Kikuyu survivors. Along with the apology, the British government will pay 20 million British pounds, roughly $30.5 million, split between the 5,228 surviving victims. The government will also help build a permanent memorial for the victims in Nairobi. According to the Kenyan Human Rights Commission, 90,000 Kenyans were executed, tortured, or maimed, and 160,000 were imprisoned in detention camps. With us now is Wanjiru Njendu. She's a producer, writer, and director, and her work includes a documentary about the Mau Mau freedom fighters. Wanjiru's own family was detained in Kenya in these camps, and she joins us now from the location of her most current film shoot. If you could give us a little bit of the history, the historic context, particularly with this reparations that have just come down from Great Britain. They've apologized to the Mau Mau people.
The war did run for a while. It really picked up from 1947 to about just before 1963 when the British finally granted independence. You know, but in that time, it's estimated based on research and you know, Caroline Elkins' research, other research, that about 90,000 Mau Mau were killed and about 160,000 Kikuyu people, either supporters, entire villages, were incarcerated.
Now, some of your own family were incarcerated, tortured.
Yes, my parents were originally from an area called Nyahururu, and they were actually moved with an entire village and put into some camps, and then when they were later released, they were relocated to the area where we call home. So yes, they were part of it, my grandparents, my father, and my father was the only son and his four sisters.
And what did they tell you about the conditions?
You know, my father says he was too young, but he remembers a lot of guns. My grandmother, my grandfather, you know, remembers that there was always a sense of fear, a sense of, you know, you never know if you could see the next day, especially for men. You know, women, children have it a little easier, but especially for men, you know, you'd never know when you'd be hauled outside and shot. And on a personal level, my grandmother, she always had a bent spine, and that's because they would let you out the camps to get firewood, to fetch water during certain times, and she was coming back and she tripped and fell, and one of the soldiers kicked her in the back and injured her back.
Say that last bit again because your phone cut out. About, so your grandmother fell and one of the soldiers came to her, you said.
Yes, he kicked her, and they used to have steel-toe boots, and so it did something to her back, to her spine, and because there was no medical attention given at the time in the camp, her spine never healed straight. So from being from a woman in the her young 20s to when she died in her 80s, my grandmother never stood up straight.
Your family, were they part of a particular tribe that was targeted, or were they actually involved in the Mau Mau rebellion? What was the reason for the detention?
My family is Kikuyu. One of my great-grandmothers was Maasai, but my family is Kikuyu. And, you know, when the British came in and took the large tracts, the most fertile culturally, so this was very personal for them. And when the struggle started, the Kikuyu were at the forefront. There were a few smaller other tribes close to Kikuyu, but it was mostly the Kikuyu who were picked up because the majority of the resistance did come from the Kikuyu.
And how long were they detained in those camps?
My father says he thinks he remembers it was just under 2 years, but again, he was young, and you know, my grandmother and grandfather couldn't really write, so they don't have any written records of how long they were there.
Now, you've made a film that documents some of the experiences of the Mau Mau freedom fighters. Tell us about that film.
It was my college thesis. I went to college in Emerson, and I wanted to do something different, and I wanted to do something personal. And for me, I chose to interview some people. I'd gotten to meet Carolyn Elkins and learned of her work and the impact she was having in moving, in documenting the stories and in documenting the experiences. And I went back and I interviewed my grandparents. I interviewed, you know, people in the village. Like, you know, it started as 5 interviews and more people kept coming out and more people kept telling of their experiences. I mean, you have people in their 70s telling you about waterboarding and, you know, being incarcerated, and brothers and fathers and sons disappearing in the forest in the middle of the night, or being British soldiers who come and crash the household and in the middle of the night and pull out the men and then never be seen again. So this story for me, the one thing is because of my grandparents were very clear, both on my mother and my father's side, in letting us know our history as a family and keeping us in the loop.
Now with these reparations, and Britain has finally apologized for its treatment of the Kikuyu people, I've heard you say that you think the reparations are really inadequate given what people have gone through.
Well, you know, money can't replace life. Money can't replace broken families. Money can't replace the torture that so many of these people went in. I believe the reparation is equivalent to about $30 million, you know, but you have movie stars making that off one paycheck of a film, you know. It's not just about the money. It's the, I think, for the ones who filed the lawsuits, the acknowledgement of this treatment and of this incarceration is what is more important. You know, they lost livelihood. They lost, you know, women lost husbands and fathers and sons. And, you know, there were cases of abuse against the women. You know, there's never enough money to correct that.
But the apology itself is a little bit more meaningful, you think?
I think it is a starting point. I think it's an issue because, you know, the outfall of this time, because what happened was the British used another tribe known as the Luo, you know, as a concentration camp guards. You know, there's still that outfall between those two big tribes 50 years later, you know, and I think the apologies and the acknowledgement and allowing the truth to come out, you know, is what the people who filed the lawsuit, that's what they were going for, that you did this to us. And so that is a starting point. It's not the only point. I think it's a starting point.
And one other thing that I have heard you say is about how Western media has treated Africa, and didn't see very much even about this particular issue with the reparations in the U.S. media. What's your general sense about Western media and its treatment?
I think the Western media, you know, and this is speaking from what I've read and also from, you know, personal experiences of seeing how different stories can be reported. I think there's a certain image that has been portrayed of Africa, not just Kenya, but of Africa in general, you know, the poverty, you know, the girl child. But, you know, Africa is quickly growing in terms of technology expansions, you know, it's the economies are recovering. And I think it's breaking the barrier of what it has been defined in. And I think when you start seeing, you know, and it's not just, you know, Western media in Africa, it's Western media, you know, the bad is always more glamorous than the good, you know. And there's an aspect of sensationalizing stories. And I think that now that the stories are not as interesting or not as dramatic, I believe that the young fellow who was in the play said it best, you know, if a dog bites a man, that's not a story. But if a man bites a dog, then you have a story. So I think it's a thing of people tend to digress more towards bad news. And, you know, when you have something like the Kenyan elections, which were peaceful, 14 million registered, 8 million turned out to vote, and there was only one big incident, one incident of violence. But that's all that, you know, CNN kept focusing on, to the point that the youth in Kenya got onto Twitter and Facebook and were like, you know, started the hashtag, someone tell CNN, this is the number of people, these are the number of constituencies. So the youth took to social media to get the right information out there, which is a first and is really fantastically brilliant.
Wanjiru Njendu, it's great to talk with you again.
It's so great to talk to you, Maria, and thank you so much. And, you know, anytime I can get to talk about this matter, it's close to my heart. A way of giving tribute to my grandparents who've already passed on.
Wanjiru Njendu is a producer, writer, and director, and her work includes a documentary about the Mau Mau freedom fighters. Stay tuned.
It's been a long time coming, but I know change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
You are listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. The landmark apology and settlement fund by Britain to the Mau Mau people in Kenya may open doors for future cases, according to some scholars. Britain's colonial rule affected people in Palestine, then Malaya, Kenya, Cyprus, Aden, and Northern Ireland. What are the politics of reparations? How have they developed over time? And where might they go? John Torpy is with us. He is a professor of sociology at the City University of New York and the author and editor of books including Making Whole What Has Been Smashed on Reparations Politics and Politics in the Past on Repairing Historical Injustices. Welcome, John Torpy. Great to have you with us. You've examined reparations through the fairly long arm of history, and you've noted that the Holocaust is really kind of the standard bearer. Can you talk about how did the idea of reparations begin, and how far have they come now?
Well, I mean, the term really goes back to and still exists as a term that refers to the debt that's owed by combatant states to the other state, to other states, as a result of damages caused by warfare. So we still owe, or Iraq still owes reparations to Kuwait for its invasion that led to the first Gulf War. But what struck me about 15 years ago was that the term seemed to be used increasingly to refer to, you know, damages, in effect, that were being paid to individuals and groups for historical wrongs. So, I mean, the first encounter that I really noticed this, I suppose, had to do, in fact, with the so-called First Nations in Canada, that is to say their indigenous populations, or what we would call Indians or Native Americans. And the Canadian government had just announced a big deal that they had worked out with these groups, and this was an attempt to sort of right their relations with these groups. And all of a sudden, it seemed to me, I started to see this use of the term everywhere. So I would say it's a product of the last 20 years. I mean, some people would say it's essentially a post-Cold War development. I mean, I think in some broader sense, it's really a consequence of what, you know, some people have called the human rights revolution, and in a certain sense, the rise of the significance of the individual in international law. In other words, a legal code or legal understanding that used to have to do really more or less exclusively with states, interstate relations, increasingly came to be applied to individuals and groups. So, I mean, I think one of the most significant results of this trend, aside from the kinds of things that we will talk about, I think, has been that the United Nations has adopted a document. It's not a convention, but it's, you know, the kind of soft law that the United Nations tends to adopt that talks about the very long title of the document, but basically it confers or seeks to confer a kind of right to reparation for wrong, for violations of human rights, gross violations of human rights, and the different kinds of wrongs and the different remedies are very diverse. But let's just talk about the remedies for the moment. You know, those remedies can be all kinds of different things, restoring people to the status quo ante, providing them with, you know, therapy and rehabilitation. You know, sometimes it has to do with money. Sometimes it has to do with restoring artworks or other, you know, possessions and things. But the term reparations, I think, in American discourse has come to basically refer to money, and that has some problematic consequences in different cases. But I think that, again, is something that arose largely as a result of settlements that were made with regard to Holocaust victims by the German government and other governments in the aftermath of World War II. So a lot of this has to do with the aftermath of World War II, but at the real takeoff, I think, the extension of this kind of language to other groups really is a post-Cold War development. The sort of reparations that were paid to interned Japanese Americans was referred to as redress, and that had some kind of particular historical background why they chose that term. But basically, the idea was that somebody said that, you know, American citizens don't have a right to reparations, but they do have a right to redress. But in effect, you know, that was the basic idea that we're talking about here. But the congressional legislation was designed very specifically to try to forestall the idea that other groups would pick up on this idea, particularly African Americans. It didn't really work very well, but that was sort of the idea.
And you've also looked at it globally, particularly mm-hmm. related to colonialism. Mm-hmm. And we've seen, of course, the development 2 weeks ago with right. the British government and the Mau Mau people. How would you put the Mau Mau reparations into the historic context and to what has happened with other colonized communities?
Well, I think that there have been attempts to go down this road before. They've been relatively unsuccessful. I mean, the one that I looked at in my book to do with the Herero people, a group that lives in what is now Namibia, which was in those days German Southwest Africa. The German government refused basically to compensate the Herero group specifically as they're currently constituted, not because, as often is the case, it's hard to say, you know, who should be the heirs of a wrong done to people, you know, let's say 100 years ago, but rather because there were a number of other groups who also suffered at the hands of the Germans. I mean, there was a kind of extermination order that related to the Hereros specifically, but it went beyond that, and another group called the Nama and others were also seriously, you know, affected by these German actions. And what the German government decided to do was to simply put this in the form of development aid to the country of Namibia, because they felt like, despite the fact that this one group was well-organized, people from a variety of different groups had suffered, and they were all now part of the larger state country of Namibia, and that they would kind of carry out their obligation to the past by transferring funds, development funds, to the country as a whole. Now, some people, of course, aren't going to be satisfied with that, but that was the German decision. And so, I mean, the problem that you have in so many of these cases is precisely that there's an issue about whether it was really just this one specific ethnic group in a country or whether lots of groups weren't suffering under the, you know, the heel of a European colonial oppressor. I mean, there was another effort that took place about 20 years ago that had to do with slavery. Some people in the United States, some of African origin, tried to sort of undertake an initiative to seek reparations for slavery for African countries. But that very quickly became complicated because it really kind of dribbled into a sort of attempt to get some sort of reparations for colonialism more generally. And the people who were behind this effort were divided over those that wanted to go more broadly in a colonial direction, which, you know, could go all over the place, really, and those who wanted to seek reparations for essentially for Africa or African countries who had been affected by American slave trade. So as a result of the kind of complexities of the history, this effort essentially ran aground and was abandoned. So, I mean, I think, you know, what you're seeing in the case of the Mau Mau is essentially a successful effort by a particular group to mobilize attention to what had happened to its people. I think a crucial thing, I mean, I don't know how much it's really the case here, but a crucial aspect of successful cases tends to be that some of the people who underwent the atrocities or the violations are still alive today. I mean, one of the problems with pursuing, you know, so-called reparations in the United States has been, insofar as that's been pursued by African Americans, is that insofar as the cause of action is slavery, the courts say, well, there's nobody who survived slavery. And hence, they have no, you know, what in legal terms is known as standing. They have no basis upon which to bring an action before the court. So sometimes the people behind the idea of reparations for Black Americans have framed it not in terms of slavery, but in terms of Jim Crow and segregation and the wrongs that arose from that, redlining practices with regard to mortgages, other ways of keeping Black people from buying houses, which is the major source of wealth, you know, in American families. So they've basically tried to pursue this on the basis of wrongs that were done to people who are still alive. So that tends to make a big difference.
Let's turn back for just a second also to the colonial periods in Africa, mainly because of this Mau Mau situation.
Right.
Is this the first successful reparation effort against British colonialization?
As far as I know, it is. But I have to say that's not necessarily my... I don't know that those cases quite as well. But as far as I know, it is the first, and that's why it got into the papers, because, of course, there's always this question. One of the reasons that many countries are so eager to avoid getting into these things is that they see it as the opening of the floodgates. And as far as I know, this is the first, and of course, there are many other potential claimants. And I think, given that this has now happened, we're likely to see more of those in India, elsewhere in Africa, etc.
When you think in terms of reparations, you've talked about different kinds of reparations that can be done. What do you think is useful in terms as a means of restorative justice?
Well, it's always very difficult. There are a variety of different violations on the basis of which people will seek to gain some sort of justice. I mean, this is all about, in the end, about justice of some sort, but that can mean many things to many people. If it's, you know, physical artifacts of some sort that have been taken away, as in artworks, which we've heard a lot about, post-Nazi Europe, you know, if those can be found and the sort of rights of ownership can be traced and that sort of thing, you know, that those can be restored. Sometimes that's not what's at issue. What's at issue is really a kind of being robbed of people's life chances. And there, what are you going to do? I mean, money may be the only way in which that can be compensated, even if that's inadequate in many, many ways. Some people will resist the idea of money because they'll see it as blood money that the perpetrators are sort of salving their consciences by giving away mere money. So it's a very complex kind of situation in which money can play a kind of solvent role, but it's not necessarily going to be satisfying for all the people involved. And as I say, with regard to this UN document, I mean, they really talk about a variety of different measures, relatively few of which have to do with money. I mean, sometimes it's that people were convicted under, say, the apartheid regime in South Africa of some political crime that wouldn't be a crime under the current democratic regime. And, you know, they want their good name restored. They want that record expunged, perhaps some sort of compensation for the disadvantage that they suffered as a result of things like that. So there's a great variety of different wrongs, and the different responses to those are also varied. I mean, in my book, I try to make distinctions essentially between cultural wrongs, some of which are very, very difficult to really do much about at this stage. I mean, the lands of Indians that they claim are essentially sacred to them, now inhabited by millions of other people in many cases, and the question is whether that's feasible, really, to do much about that.
Where do you see this going as an international issue in the future, given that the United Nations did adopt this? I think this was the Basic Principles and Guidelines.
That's right.
Yeah, on the right
to
remedy. It's
a very long title.
Right.
With gross violations of human rights.
Right. And so they've adopted this loosely, as you said. I think that was 2005 or 2006.
Right, something like that. Something.
Do you see it developing into a more robust and more enforceable standard?
Well, I think this is largely, many of the violations in question are violations of human rights law. Whether or not the violations in question are violations of a country's laws is a different question. UN law tends to be not really enforceable, hence this notion of soft law. But the kinds of things that we're talking about, I think most people wouldn't, there's no doubt that, you know, people were wronged in some way, but it's a question of how to, you know, make amends for that. I think it is the sort of thing that essentially is a matter of negotiation, and particularly where groups are involved, where the representatives of some group, say the Herero in Namibia, pursue this case. They make the claim, as they did, that what became the Holocaust started here because of various predecessors doing genetic, sort of eugenicist kind of practices and things like that, that what happened to us was like the Holocaust. I mean, I think I say in the book that I think the more likely you are, the better you are at framing what happened to you as sort of like the Holocaust, the better your chances are of getting some sort of response. And so, you know, I don't think it's the sort of thing that can really be enforceable per se, but will always be kind of a matter of politics and of negotiation, which is why I talk about reparations politics in this book, because it really is a way of doing politics. It's a way of getting certain kinds of things, in this case for particular groups usually, at the subnational level, on the basis of, you know, wrongs that were done in the past. But it's always going to be a question of mobilization and success in getting the ear of the right court, perhaps, or of the right politician, and trying to pursue one's case in that way. But it's in general a kind of juridification or legalization of the social and political environment. And I think the point, in a way, is that these ideas are now out there and people can try to pursue them, and some will be successful and some will not.
Well, John Torpy, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
John Torpy is a professor of sociology at the City University New York Graduate Center and the author of books including Making Whole What Has Been Smashed on Reparations Politics and Politics in the Past on Repairing Historical Injustices. When we come back, a refugee crisis of epic proportions marks World Refugee Day. How has it come to this and what can be done? Stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. As the international community marks World Refugee Day, the refugee count has risen higher than any other time since 1994. 45.2 million people were displaced in 2012, according to the United Nations Refugee Agency, and 7.6 million people were newly displaced that year. Of the displaced people, nearly 30 million were forced to flee but remain within their own countries, while another 15.5 million have sought refuge elsewhere. Each day in 2012, an average of 23,000 more people have been displaced. The greatest numbers were either in the Democratic Republic of Congo or in Syria. But why has the refugee crisis reached such proportions, and what can be done about it? We have with us three experts. Elizabeth Ferris is a senior fellow in foreign policy and the co-director of the Brookings Institute Project on Internal Displacement. She's the author of The Politics of Protection, The Limits of Humanitarian Action. Karen Musolo also joins us. Karen Musolo is professor of law at the University of California Hastings College of Law and founding director of the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies. She is co-author of Do They Hear When You Cry? And Refugee Law and Policy, A Comparative and International Approach. Gilbert Burnham is co-director of the Center for Refugee and Disaster Response at Johns Hopkins University. He has worked extensively in emergency preparedness and response and humanitarian needs assessment with numerous humanitarian and health development programs throughout Africa, Asia, and Eastern Europe. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us. I'd like to start with Elizabeth Ferris. You wrote in one of your pieces that World Refugee Day reminds us of our failures as an international community. Why do you say that?
Sure. Here we are in 2013 and still displacing millions of people, both internally within the borders of their country and as refugees. I mean, the numbers are just far too high for this day and age. I think we should be able to do better to prevent the violence and conflicts that is displacing so many people.
What is the scope of it? What are we facing in terms of numbers?
Well, if you look in terms of refugees, that is people who have crossed a border because of conflict, persecution or massive violations of human rights. The number is about 15 million, of whom 5 million are Palestinian refugees, and the other 10 million are spread in 100 different countries around the world. But if you add to that those who are displaced within the borders of their country, also because of conflict, violence, or human rights violations, the numbers go way up. There are about 28 million displaced by conflict. And then when you add people who are displaced by natural disasters, at least sudden onset natural disasters, the figure climbs even higher. There are about 38 million who were displaced in the past year because of disasters.
Now, the United Nations has said this is actually the worst it's been in about two decades. Gilbert Burnham?
Yes, I think that we probably reached the previous high water mark with the genocide in Rwanda and the massive movement of populations into DR Congo and Tanzania. And then things settled down for a while, and I think with the continuing upheaval, particularly in the Middle East and with the unresolved situations with Iraqi refugees, with Afghan refugees, and now with the increasing numbers of Syrian refugees, I think we're going to see even a higher number reached in the near future. And to follow on what Elizabeth said, we have another classification that we're seeing very much in Syria right now, and those are the people who would like to be displaced if they could, but they're trapped because of conflict or trapped because of hostile forces on various sides, and they really can't get out. They can't get access to any type of services. They can't get access to humanitarian assistance that is available within Syria.
So then what distinguishes the internal displaced people from people who are under siege? Is it just that they're stuck in their home?
Well, the other thing that distinguishes them is that once that you're outside of the country, then the international humanitarian networks, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees and others can provide protection and assistance. But inside the country, the displaced populations or the people who would like to flee really don't have much in the way of protection. And dealing with this population in Syria right now is an extremely difficult and fraught undertaking.
Just one more thing on Syria and Iraq. I understand from your writing, Gilbert Burnham, that you already had, I think it was 2 million or 3 million Iraqis that were in Syria as refugees, and then the Syrian crisis happened. Where do they go? What happens to them now?
Well, most of them are either en route back to Iraq or are in Iraq already, and this is producing quite a bit of strain on Iraq, and a large number have gone back to Basra. Some have gone back to the area around Baghdad, but Iraq still has 1.1 million internally displaced people from the conflict, and I just returned 2 days ago from Baghdad, and this is a situation that's not resolving, and I don't think people expect it to resolve. So I think we're going to see a very substantial jump in the number of internally displaced people within the country.
And I'll want to go back to that a bit more, but let's bring Karen Musalo in now. What is it that you would add in terms of the scope and the driving forces of this problem?
Well, I think that my colleagues have really identified that, you know, refugees come into existence or eternally displaced because of the failures, in a way, the tragic failures of the international community to help resolve the conflicts and the situations that give, you know, rise to this, you know, to the persecution, the risk that people are put at in conflicts. And so I think that too often refugees are seen as part of a quote-unquote immigration problem to deal with. And I think that it really behooves us to look more deeply and to say, you know, these are the victims of the failures of nation states and of the international community to stop conflict or to, you know, try to negotiate settlements or to somehow be a positive force. The refugees and the internally displaced are really, you know, populations at great risk, and they call for a humanitarian response. And I think that all too often, many countries just want to, you know, pull up the gangplank and fortify their borders and keep people out. And that's really not the solution. The solution has to be to address the problems that cause people to flee. And I think that my two colleagues on the panel have really identified a number of very serious conflicts that are raging that are giving rise to this high mark of refugees and internally displaced people at this point in time.
Now, I understand also that there's the gendered component to the problem with both the refugees and the internally displaced people. Karen Musala, while I've got you talking now, why don't you tell us what you've seen in your research? I think all three of you have written about this from different aspects.
My focus, thank you. My focus has been quite a bit on how the international community interprets the refugee definition. The refugee definition came into existence in the aftermath of World War II, and I think it came into existence in a time period when there wasn't a full recognition of women's rights as being human rights, and there was really a male paradigm to who was a refugee. A refugee was somebody fleeing a violation of their civil or political rights. And as the women's rights rights activists really became a potent force and made the point that the violation of women's rights is a human rights violation, and practices that, you know, harms or forms of persecution that affect women, predominantly affect women or are unique to women, that they are deserving of being brought within the refugee definition and given protection. But that there's really been quite a bit of resistance, and my focus has been a lot on more the Western industrialized countries that receive refugees and adjudicate refugee claims and who they actually recognize within their judicial systems as refugees. And it has been a real struggle to obtain the recognition that women who are often, you know, the sort of range of things that happen to women during conflict and even in times of peace, so whether it's being raped, forcibly impregnated during conflict, taken as sexual slaves by warring forces, or in societies where they're subject to practices like forced marriage or female genital cutting or could be the victims of honor killing. So these are all the kinds of things that women may cross borders to try to escape to save their lives from. And a lot of resistance in recognizing these forms of harm as persecution within the meaning of the refugee definition. So I know there's a lot to say in the perspective probably that that Gilbert Burnham and Elizabeth Ferris can bring to this, looking at among the internally displaced and among refugees outside industrialized countries who are in camps or otherwise in precarious situations.
You've been prompted, Elizabeth Ferris. Let's start with you.
Yeah, I mean, I think you also see not only are women fleeing gender-based violence and in horrific situations, but too often in the places where they're seeking protection, they find more violence and exploitation. I just came back from Jordan and Lebanon looking at the situation of Syrian refugees, where you see certain increases in domestic violence, for example, in camp settings. But most of the Syrian refugees are not living in camps. They're living in the community and largely invisible. And so we heard stories, for example, of a Syrian family renting a house from a Lebanese landlord, and the Lebanese landlord saying, oh, you can't pay the rent. Well, how about if you give your 12-year-old daughter to my cousin as a bride? You know, this early marriage, for example, has become quite common. And if I could say something more about internal displacement, I think Gilbert is right that sometimes those who are displaced are not the most vulnerable. You know, sometimes it's people with disabilities or elderly or people who for one reason or another can't leave their homes as easily as those who are able to make it to another city or even to another country. And yet people who are displaced lose not only their shelter, but often they lose their social protection networks. You know, you move to a strange town and you don't know where is a safe road or where are the landmines or who do you trust or where can I get water. So I think there are particular vulnerabilities that come with displacement, but that people who are trapped, who can't get out, may in fact be even needier and harder to assist than those who have moved.
Gilbert Burnham.
Just to pick up on what Elizabeth said, we have just finished a study of elderly Syrian displaced populations in Lebanon, And the circumstances of many of these are really appalling, and I think that if we hadn't been out specifically looking for it, we would have missed this population completely. And these are people with a number of chronic diseases. These are people who've lost key members of their household, and there are people in Lebanon without any type of formal assistance programs. And the various groups that are there more or less stumble across these groups, many of whom don't want to be registered with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees Office because they're afraid they can be traced back to having left the country if they wish to return in the future. And so they're in a very difficult situation. I think we're starting to appreciate this more than we did in the past. And one of the difficulties we've had with our refugee populations have been many of our policies, and especially true of the public health side of things, have been focused on the rural African peasant who moves across the border, reconstructs the house out of grass and sticks and mud. And now we're dealing with a largely urban population, more educated, more subject to non-communicable diseases, chronic diseases than we saw in the past. That's made a major shift. And now we're also in a situation where only a third of refugees, really as recognized refugees outside of their country, are living in refugee camps. And the rest of them, and I think as Elizabeth mentioned, are living in between the spaces and out of sight and difficult to reach. And this is becoming an increasing problem among Syrians and Turkey, and creating a lot of tensions with the local populations. But then just to finish with something that that Karen mentioned, and we've been looking at gender-based violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo in the eastern area, in the Kivu area. This is internally displaced people by the continuing internationalized local conflict there. And we're finding a number of men that have been subject to gender-based violence. And when we first noted this earlier with Sudanese refugees, we checked in with a number of groups that look at gender-based violence, and they said, well, we only do women, we don't do men. And we're finding this to be a very economically and socially devastating event that happens to males, many of whom are having a difficult time ever recovering from it.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudin, and we're talking in the wake of World Refugee Day about the magnitude of the refugee crisis, how we got here, and what we need to do now to resolve the problem. What you're describing is pretty horrific. Does it seem like it's really getting worse in terms of the atrocities and the circumstances that people are facing that are victims of the conflicts? Or does it seem to be more of the same? Karen Musolo?
Well, I was thinking that one of the things I'd like to do is bring the issue into sort of the current debate we're having in the U.S. about comprehensive immigration reform. And one piece of it that's very relevant to refugees and victims of persecution is there's a clamor for, stopping illegal immigration and fortifying our border. And really, the way in which many people fleeing persecution access protection is to illegally cross borders. I mean, we know, during the Holocaust that the people who we lionized as being heroes were the people who provided false documents to allow the Jews to flee the Holocaust. And it's not, different in the sense that individuals who are fleeing persecution have to often cross borders illegally. And so when we in the U.S. talk about, making it more difficult to enter our country as, same situation within the European Union, Australia, so many countries. So as the situation, I think, does worsen with these conflicts around the world and the human rights violations that accompany them, we are making it more difficult for people to flee and to seek protection. And, I want to bring in the being in the U.S. and having some ability to perhaps influence, or illuminate the issues that are being debated. We don't have a visa that somebody could apply to who wants to seek asylum in the U.S. The way that they seek protection in the U.S. is to make their way across the border. And we have so many deaths in the desert and along the border because we've made it so dangerous for people to cross borders. So many people who perish at sea, so people fleeing different countries from Africa who, you know, are trying to make it to Spain or Italy, who perish when their small craft capsizes, and Haitians who have tried to flee to the U.S. and the same. So I think the issue that I want to, you know, agree with what Gilbert and Elizabeth have said about the dire nature of the situation, but also talk about the need that countries have to have a humanitarian response and to find ways to enable or facilitate, you know, the flight of individuals and their entry into countries where they can seek protection. And the U.S. is included in that calculus. I see the U.S. only making it more difficult and more dangerous for individuals to enter to seek protection.
Well, you beat me to the last question that I was going to go to, so let's just go there. But maybe on the way, Elizabeth Ferris, you've written about the politics of protection and specifically about why some groups get protection, but others that are equally needy do not. What do you find are the primary factors?
Well, and to pick up on what Karen was saying, I think we see a global trend of governments closing their borders through various means. I mean, usually they don't say the border is closed, but they can do like Turkey is doing now, managing migration, or have, you know, so many bureaucratic and visa requirements that it's impossible for people who are generally fearful for their life to find protection in other countries. And I think that the more that developed industrialized countries do that, the more it gives permission to other countries in regions where there's large-scale conflict to do the same. But also, to go back to your question about are things worse now, I really don't know. I mean, you look at the Rwandan genocide or the neighbors killing neighbors in Bosnia. I mean, things were pretty horrific, you know, back in the 1990s. I don't think there was ever a real golden age, if you were. What's different now, though, I think, is that we see it. I mean, there's, you know, thousands of hours of the Syrian conflict on YouTube and Twitter, and people reporting from, you know, live ordinary citizens about their experiences. We no longer have that excuse of saying, oh, we didn't know this was happening. We didn't know how bad it was. And I remember in the early days of the Rwandan genocide, as news just kind of trickled out, and find this horror of reading faxes and telexes. Oh my gosh, can this really be going on? But not realizing the full import of it for days after the violence had broken out. And now it's happening in real time and on our TV screens, and it's there. And I think that's one of the reasons I feel this anger that we aren't doing better. We don't have that excuse now to say, oh, we didn't really know what was going on. So it may not be worse in quantitative terms, but I think it's worse in terms of the impact and the responsibility we should feel for these situations.
And in terms of the structure of protection or the politics of protection, which you have studied extensively, do you have a sense of why some people do get protected and others don't?
Well, I think here, if we look at the situation of internally displaced persons compared with refugees, you see that our international system is built on sovereignty. It's the responsibility of national governments to protect and assist those who are displaced within their borders, even when sometimes it's that government that's responsible for the displacement. It's hard for international actors to intervene or to take actions to address both the causes or care for them. So there are differential standards right there. If you make it across the border, I mean, you have access usually to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, a big, fairly effective international organization that protects and assists refugees. But if you stop short, you know, if you're 10 miles inside Syria, you don't have access to those systems of protection. And that's really a function of the international system that we live in, where, you know, governments are sovereign in the actions they take within their own borders.
Gilbert Burnham, let's bring you back in now in terms of the structures that people can go to if there are enough. What needs to be changed that you see on the international level?
Well, I think there's several levels, and one of them, we're seeing a constant shift in the type of refugees and their protection needs and their health needs and their educational needs. So we have to be keeping up with this trend, and one of the areas we've fallen really behind in has been how do we care for urban refugees. And this, as I said earlier, the system really is still focused on the rural peasants, and the Iraqi situation was a real wake-up call when Vast amounts of money had to be spent in treatment of cardiac diseases and treatment of renal diseases and so forth. So it became a really expensive operation, and we started to see that this is a much different population than we've been set up to manage through the international structure. So one of the things is that we need to keep up with the changes in things. And I think from a more legal side of things, which I'm not really entitled to talk about, is the whole idea of protection and who constitutes persons of concern, persons of interest. And I think there is a recognition that we need to look at transcending the sovereignty issues at times. But the whole redefinition that Karen has done a lot with, that needs to be pushed forward much better. And then I think from our side in public health, what we're trying to do is to look at how do we measure situations more effectively, how do we get a better understanding of what's happening and in a dynamic sense. And as Elizabeth mentioned, we know a lot more about it. We understand probably less. Recent surveys both in the U.S. and in U.K. have shown that, you know, only perhaps 10 or 15% of the population really understands the magnitude of the loss of life among civilians in Iraq. So we've been exposed to it, but we can't handle the numbers. We're locked in denial. We have a lot of issues with that somehow we need to be better communicators about.
Well, Gilbert Burnham, a couple of things that you've written about that I just wanted to get your thoughts on now. One deals with the impact of food prices, and the other is just trying to get people into employment and getting a place to live. How is that occurring now? You're talking about how much it's changing and how much needs to be done. And do we have the resources to be able to do this massive amount of people in trouble?
Well, I think there are a number of issues that we can see played out right now in Lebanon, for example. And the influx of Syrians there has driven up the price of housing. It has driven up the access to food. Lebanon is not a signatory to the Refugee Convention. It has no formal structure to provide assistance. People are living in makeshift camps, in unfinished construction, and so on. So they're having a really difficult time. Do we have the resources? I think we have the resources. But I think coming back to something Elizabeth said earlier, sometimes humanitarian assistance has been characterized as the humanitarian fig leaf that really covers our shame because we've not been able to take the decisive political actions. We don't have the will to be able to head off some of these events before they really fester and they really become something that is really a stretch to manage.
Karen Musila, let's bring you back in because Gilbert Burnham started to talk about the international legal system. How do you see it?
Well, I think there's probably two pieces, and they're very obvious ones. I mean, they're obvious, but they're very intractable and difficult to address. But one is that we really need to allow better ability for people fleeing persecution to access territories of protection. And that's a large issue because, as Elizabeth said, this concept of sovereignty and about crossing borders and every country having the right to determine who can enter their country and under what circumstances. But there are international norms and the right to seek asylum and the norm of non-refoulement to not return a person to a country of persecution. So number one, I think we need, as an international community, to come up with a better way to allow the movement of people fleeing persecution to leave their country and to enter other countries. And we need to really shame those countries that engage in refoulement, that engage in the return of people to situations of persecution. It simply should not be accepted to return people to their death and their torture. And number two, that's sort of a procedural issue in a way. And number two, on a substantive level, it's the definition of who should come within the definition of a refugee, who deserves protection. And again, to bring it back to the U.S. borders, we see now the skyrocketing numbers of unaccompanied children from Central America trying to enter the U.S. because of intolerable levels of all forms of abuse, of organized crime and gangs preying upon children. And I think that the definition of a refugee needs to evolve with the societal and political and historical realities of our world. And to send a 12-year-old back, you know, there's documented case of a young Honduran who was fleeing a gang. He told an immigration judge that if he was sent back to Honduras, it was either Honduras or Guatemala, so I apologize for not remembering which of those two countries, he said that he would be killed. And within several months of being returned, he was in fact shot to death, a young teenage kid. So, I mean, we need to look at who we bring within the refugee definition, not strain it so far that people feel that it doesn't have viability as a concept, but we need to look at who really is at risk of serious and grave violations of their human rights, and as an international community, we need to find room to bring them within the refugee definition and to protect them.
Elizabeth Ferris.
Yes, I definitely agree. I mean, the gang violence, the criminal elements are also linked to what Gilbert was talking about, this new phenomena of urban refugees or urban displacement. When people flee violence for the cities, you know, cities are often violent places, and they may get caught up in a violence that they thought they were trying to escape. And, you know, provision of humanitarian assistance is much more complicated in a city when you've got lots of different actors, and the best way of helping refugees and IDPs may in fact be to support local government health programs or local municipal authorities.
I think that's a perfect place to end. Let me thank the three of you. We really appreciate you coming on with us and sharing your research with us and our listeners. Elizabeth Ferris, Karen Musolo, and Gilbert Burnham, thank you.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Ferris is a senior fellow in foreign policy and the co-director of the Brookings Institute Project on Internal Displacement. She's the author of The Politics of Protection, The Limits of Humanitarian Action. Karen Musolo is professor of law at the University of California Hastings College of Law and founding director of the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies. She is co-author of Do They Hear When You Cry? And Refugee Law and Policy, A Comparative and International Approach. Gilbert Burnham is co-director of the Center for Refugee and Disaster Response at Johns Hopkins University. He has worked extensively in emergency preparedness and response and humanitarian needs assessment with numerous humanitarian and health development programs throughout Africa, Asia, and Eastern Europe. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to the Scholar Circle team who makes this show possible, Ankina Aghasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, and Joe Pinto. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed a part of the show, you can go back either to the kpfk.org audio archives, or you can go to scholarcircle.org. You can hear us on iTunes and on Stitcher, and you can follow me at Armudian. Tune in next week as we go inside the brain of serial killers.